So today we're going to talk about our fifth installment of the series Timeless, where we're covering over the course of 3 months an overview of the entire Bible. Anybody read the Bible in 3 months? All right, we're overachievers. It's okay. That's why we're doing this series. Where do we start? Where do we finish? Where do we dig in, right? We have all of this in front of us. It's a little overwhelming, very overwhelming. So our purpose is to give you a little bit of the highlights, a little bit of the fun stuff we see, a little bit of the harsh stuff, and in hopes that when you leave here, you don't just know that little bit, but you'll go back and read about something that caught your attention, caught your eye, okay? One source states that the average person will take 74 hours and 28 minutes if they want to read the entire Bible. Long time? It's a while, isn't it? Breaks down 56 hours, 44 minutes for the Old Testament. 17 hours, 44 minutes for the New Testament. Seems like a fair amount of time still. If you want to read the entire Bible in 1 year, it's 12 minutes a day. Think about that. 12 minutes. Dr. Google, if you get online and search, says on average, we waste 2 hours a day on social media. 2 hours a day we waste checking emails. And I don't know about you guys, but I get like a million spam emails. And I'm a sucker. I still read them. I don't know why. I know they're spam, but okay. 35 minutes we waste just trying to decide what we want to eat for the day. Anybody have that problem? Hey, Jackie, where do you want to eat tonight? I don't know, Nick. Where do you want to eat? Addison, where do you want to eat? I know she's down there. I'm going to say her name anyways. Addison, where do you want to eat? I don't care. Okay? Here's the shocker. Men, you waste 14 minutes a day trying to decide what to wear. Is that funny, ladies? Women, you ready? I'll be honest with you, it's not as bad as I thought. You waste 16 minutes a day deciding what to wear. I couldn't find a stat on how long it took us to get ready we waste time with, but literally 2 more minutes for a woman. That's impressive to me. I thought it was going to be double that. Denny, I was with you on this, okay? So far, five in, we've covered 12 books of the Bible. You guys got it memorized? You ready? Let's repeat them. Genesis. Wow. Oh, good job. So some of you passed kindergarten. Nice job. You could read. Man, I was really impressed. I thought you guys were killing this. Nice job, right? So these books have taken us from the moment of creation through Abram's call, right? The Jewish exodus from Egypt, the settling of the promised land, and then the rise and the fall of Israel. Covers about 2,000 years. It's a long time. PD talked about, for those of you who were here last week, he talked about Christopher Columbus, right? 500 years. That's four times that. It's a long time. It's about eight times as long as the United States has been in existence. Look at everything that's happened here in that time span. That's a lot. It's a lot. So this morning, we're going to cover 5 more books. I know it's a lot. Trust me. When he said to me, Nick, you're going to get 5 books, I was like, whew, you want me to do 5 books in 20 minutes? Let's rock and roll. Okay? The books we're going to cover today review God's judgment and confinement of Israel by the pagan empires of Assyria and Babylon. The first 2 books we're going to start with, He briefly mentioned them last week if you were here. If you didn't, go back and listen to the message. It's really, really good. But he briefly mentioned them last week because he compared 1 and 2 Kings to 1 and 2 Chronicles. But there's a difference here. So we're going to start with 1 and 2 Chronicles. The name Chronicles simply means the words of the days. Think of it. It's like a logbook or a journal that they were keeping based on the events and timeline of the day. Similar to like what we do in our U.S. government, we have the congressional records, right? Same exact thing. If you're a truck driver, we keep logbooks, right? Used to be paper. Now I think it's all electronic. Is that right, John? Okay. It keeps track of what you've done for the day. So think of Chronicles much like this. Pretty easy. It's exactly how it reads. The book was originally one book at the end of the Hebrew Bible. Thank heavens they split it into two so we could assign one and two instead of just reading one. Right? It's a lot easier to read two small ones than one giant one. And based on Jewish tradition, it was written in the 5th century BC by a priest named Ezra, which we'll be talking about a book in his name after this in just a little bit, okay? So PD mentioned 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, similarities. If you were with us last year, or if you paid attention online a little bit, we had a Bible reading plan that we read through that covered what? The Gospels, right? A harmony of the Gospels. Harmony of Gospels was simply, they took Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, put them in chronological order, and compared the four books side by side. Sometimes somebody didn't have something to say about a topic, and other times somebody had two or three people had things to say. When we look at 1st and 2nd Kings and 1st and 2nd Chronicles, we have to think along this same line, because it's all about perspective that we're talking about. 1st and 2nd Kings is a history of Israel from the viewpoint of the prophets. 1st and 2nd Chronicles is a history from God's perspective, from the priests. The books of Kings gives us a human standpoint. Chronicles gives us a divine standpoint. Kings shows man ruling. Chronicles shows God overruling. If you read Kings, Hezekiah gets three verses in the book of Kings, in the books of Kings. He gets three chapters in the books of Chronicles. It's a big difference there. But it's all about perspective. The Kings were written for Jews in exile. Chronicles was written, and it showed how they got there. It showed them the fault of their leaders. It showed them the fault of the kings. It showed them all of the sins that they had bore. And in Chronicles, it is written for the Jews who are returning from exile. And their big question was, is God's covenant still in effect? Now, we've all been children. Some of us still are children. Roman, okay? I know in my life, I have messed up to the point where I had to look somebody in the face and question in my heart, could that person ever forgive me? Could they? Have I harmed them to the point, or have I embarrassed them or ruined something in their life that they would say, it's still okay? Anybody else relate to that? That's a tough place to be in. It's a very lonely place to be in. The Jews are the same way. They have constantly watched them destroy what God has blessed them with. And in turn, they wanted to know, hey, God, do you still love us? Like, you said you'd give us the promised land. Is that still a thing? Are we still, like, good on the contract, or did we break this? We've all been there. But in Chronicles, the hope of Israel is renewed again, and God doesn't give up on his people. I want you to turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 34. First Chronicles 16:34. I don't know about you guys, but I love hearing the rustle of paper. I do. All right, so we're there. 1 Chronicles 16:34. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His love endures forever. How long does it endure? 5 minutes? Forever, right? When I mess up, does it go away? No, it's still there. So when we go to 1 and 2 Chronicles, there are really five key passages and lessons for your spiritual life that I want you to focus on. Okay? The first is the prayer of Jabez, and that's in 1 Chronicles 4, verses 9 through 10. This is a big prayer of faith that we see from Jabez, because he refused to concede that the circumstances of his life would shape and dictate his life course. How many of us come from broken families? Okay? How many of us have friends that are from broken families? How many of us feel the wounds from all of this? It's real, isn't it? We call this, we say, we are on the family cycle. And how many of us say, I don't want to be like that. The cycle has to end with me. That's Jabez. Sometimes that's hurt. Sometimes that's pain. Sometimes it's anger. But it has to end. Jabez makes that choice. His mother had severe pain when he was born, and he prayed that God would take that pain from him. Second lesson I want you to look at is a picture of presumption. We're going to 1 Chronicles chapter 13, and we're going to look at Uzzah. So for many years, the Jews had a thing called the Ark of the Covenant. Think of this like a giant chest, okay? I'm simplifying here, oversimplifying it. And they would carry it from place to place, and you were never allowed to touch the Ark of the Covenant. Only certain people were allowed to move it, and there were rules. Now, if I asked a couple of the guys in here to grab this giant box and haul it, how many of you would want to put your hands up to steady the thing if you were going over a rough patch? I know I would. If there was something really important in there and I didn't want to drop it, I'd touch it. Here's the problem. God said, don't touch it. And Uzzah decides, I'm going to put my hand out and touch it and steady it so that it doesn't tip over and fall. He did it because he thought it was important. He felt that it was important. The reality is he broke what God said to do. Don't touch it. So he's attempting to do things that we think are right, but they're not always done in the right way. We have to remember that with God. Are we doing it his way? Or are we doing it how we think he would want it done because that's how I would want it done? The third thing I want you to look at, 1 Chronicles 16, verses 4 through 36. And this is a psalm of thanksgiving. If you want to know anything about worship, this is where you want to go. New Testament. We have the disciples all sitting with Jesus, and they say to him, Lord, teach us how to pray. Pretty simple thing, isn't it? Teach us how to pray. How would you do this? It's not that easy, right? But he gives us a list. He gives us verses that show us how to do it. So how do we worship? We go back to the book. And in 1 Chronicles, he shows us how to worship. This is an instruction manual. If people don't know how to do something, feel free to come back here. It'll tell you how to do it. If you don't understand it, reach out to a brother or a sister and say, hey, help me find it. It's here. Okay? The fourth lesson is the pleasure of God. And this is a big one because God delights in those people who have his interests at heart. This sets up the entire story of Solomon, and it's going to be in 2 Chronicles 1, sets up the entire story of Solomon who begins rebuilding the temple or building the temple for worship, okay? For 480 years, the Jews literally wandered around worshiping in a tent. How many people here camp? Got a lot of campers, wow. How many of you camped when you first started camping in a tent? Wow. How many of you have upgraded? Oh, wait, hang on. How many of you upgraded to a pop-up? Got a couple. How many have upgraded to a small fifth wheel or a travel trailer? How many of you upgraded to the Taj Mahal? Okay. So there's a few, right? When you're in the Taj Mahal, does it feel like, I'm never going back to a tent, right? Never, right? You never want to go back. For 480 years, they worshipped in a tent. Solomon built them a temple. A temple for God in one location. Are you still talking about tents? Okay. The fifth thing we're going to talk about is a promise of restoration. To me, this is the big one, okay? God presents the key ingredients about spiritual restoration to his nation. And I want you to turn to 2 Chronicles 7, verse 14. Second Chronicles 7, verse 14 reads, "Then if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sins and restore their land." That's a pretty powerful promise. But it involves a choice by us. If my people, we are his people. Remember, his promise is there for us. We have to make the choice. Okay? So that finishes out 1 and 2 Chronicles. I would ask you guys, if something struck your fancy, go back and look at it. Read. There's a lot of information in there. Okay? Now we're going to look at three more books. Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And if you remember last spring, early summer, PD touched a little bit on this during our prepper series, if you were here during that. If not, you can go back and find it in our old messages. It's actually really, really good. So, what do these three books do? These three books cover the history of the Jewish people in exile, and it relates to their trials, tribulation, and triumphs as they return to the promised land. Last week, PD talked about Israel splitting into the northern tribes and the southern tribes. Everybody remember this? Big split. Southern tribe, named Judah, right? Was run by a guy named Rehoboam. It's okay. Solomon's son. Kind of a knucklehead, got a lot of really bad advice, didn't really play well with others, wanted things done his way. So the other tribes took their ball and decided to head north. Okay? They picked a guy named Jeroboam, who was kind of like the right-hand man, a middle administrator for Solomon. But this guy didn't really want to do anything with the old customs. Set up a new capital, set up his own place as a worship for idols, not necessarily for God. And the two separate nations started to do this. You ever had a brother or sister you did that with? seen things from two very different eyes. I think we've all been there. Listen to you two. I'm going to make you guys hug in a minute if you guys keep arguing over there. Okay? Anybody's parents ever make them do that? If you're going to fight, you're going to hug, right? So here's the problem, though. The northern tribe, southern tribe, while they're fighting, they also had some surrounding communities, and Petey touched on the Ite communities. Remember this? Did anybody look up what Ite means? Nobody did the homework? Oh, my goodness. I'm just kidding. I did it only so I could say. Ite typically is a meaning of people of, okay? Shemites, people of the lineage of Shem. Make sense? Got it? So while the two nations are fighting, the outside groups are fighting with them, it's kind of chaotic. On the side, we have another group of people just waiting for an opportunity to strike. If you were going to take a country, would you do it when they were primed and ready for you? Or do you do it when they're at their weakest? At their weakest, right? This is exactly what happens. And the Assyrians invade the northern country. And they start to deport the people that live there. Now, you and I think of deportation probably from what we see on the media now, right? Some guys get arrested or some ladies get arrested. They go in front of a judge. They get all this criminal trial stuff done. And then we send them back to their native country. Deport here doesn't mean that. Deport here means we're going to either kill you or breed you out. That's how it happens. So deportation and deporting of the northern tribes are nowhere the same. The whole purpose of the Assyrians was to eradicate the Jews that were there. Fortunately, some of them survived. As the Assyrians are in power and they think they're controlling things, bang, we see the next group. The Babylonians come in and they overtake the whole thing, okay? Not only the northern, but they also take over the southern tribe. And to make sure there weren't any Jews left, they really tried hard. They deported Judah three times. Not once, not twice, three. If you got rid of somebody three times, I think you really want them gone. I know I would get the hint after the second time, like, these people don't want me here. But not the Jews. They're like, this is our land. We're not leaving. So once the Babylonians get comfortable, a third group comes to power, and we're looking at the Persians, okay? They might have had powder, I don't know. But they come to power. And we're looking at the Media-Persian Empire. And the Media-Persian Empire ends up being the largest empire as they overtake Babylon and all of the surrounding areas. This empire stretched 3,000 miles and covered an equivalent of 2 million square miles. Farmers, 2 million square miles, a lot of space? It is, isn't it? Anybody know how many square miles the United States has? Somebody want to take a stab? No? 600? 600,000? Nah. 2 million square miles is roughly half, a little more than half the size of the United States. But not just the continental United States. You have to think of Canada. Or not Canada, I'm sorry. Canada's not part of the United States. You have to think of Alaska. You have to go across Canada. Think of Alaska. And then don't forget the Hawaiian Islands. You know, they encompass so much space. We don't want to leave them out. So United States is about 3.9 million square miles. Persian Empire was big, really big. And think about the location of where it's at. That's a lot of space. Think of how many small countries exist there right now. It's a lot of land. But the big thing that came out of the Media-Persian Empire, or the Persian Empire, wasn't the fact that they took all of this over and they ruled over the Jews. It was the fact that they had kings in power who decided it was time for the Jewish nation to rebuild itself. God touched their hearts, and instead of keeping them in captivity, they decided to turn them loose. This is where we get to the book of Ezra. Thought I missed a page. And the book of Ezra really can be broken into two different sections. Okay, the first is the rebuilding of the temple walls, and that encompasses Ezra chapters 1 through 6. And we see Cyrus the Great. He is the first big king of Persia. And his first thing he did after conquering Babylon was he said to the Jews, I'm going to pass an edict, and an edict is just a fancy name for a law or a rule that says, you guys are going to go back to your promised land. And you're going to go back there, and you're going to rebuild all the temple walls. And the Jews are thinking, we don't have anything. How are we going to do this? And Cyrus says, we're going to send everything back with you. Everything that's been taken from you, we're going to send with you. So we're going to fund the project. Now go. Interesting part is, Cyrus is actually prophesied by name to do this 150 years beforehand by Isaiah and Jeremiah. So the people knew it was coming if they'd have just listened. They said it was going to happen. So a group of Jews led by a guy named, Zerubbabel, Zeb, okay, who was a descendant of Dave, he led the first group of Jews back to Judah, and they laid the foundation walls on the new temple, which ended the 70 years of predicted captivity that they were going to find from the Assyrians and the Babylonians. It wasn't just Cyrus. Cyrus laid the initial groundwork for them to do it. If you look at the Persian Empire, there are a bunch of kings, and we're not going to cover them all because there's way too many. But another guy down the king lineage is a guy by the name of King Darius. And he did the same thing. He stood up for the Jews and encouraged the rebuilding of the temple. Now, we're in the process of rebuilding a bunch of roads around here, and we know how long that takes. Okay? Decades, is what you said? Yeah, it feels that way, doesn't it? The temple took this long, too. They didn't have modern machinery. They didn't have all the fancy tools. What they had was manpower and a desire. So it took time. So King Darius is now in his rule. He says, we're going to send even more back. So this time he sends two Jewish prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, and he starts to stir it up. You ever started a project and it kind of goes lame? Doesn't it? I've had a couple like that. Jackie yells at me. It's okay. Start a good project, you're really motivated. You get 2 weeks into it and you're like, man, this was only supposed to take a few days. The same thing happens with the temple here, okay? They get bogged down. But Haggai and Zechariah, they go back around and like, hey guys, we really got to finish this. And they get it done. And the temple is completed in 516 BC. So now that the temple's done, we need to look at the second half of Ezra. And we're looking at chapters 7 through 10. And we're looking at restoring temple worship. So they've got this building. What are we going to do with it now? We're going to use it. Is it just a giant billboard? How are we going to handle it? So back in Persia, there's a new king. Seems to be a common theme. New king, new king, new king. And this one has the name Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes. And he let the priest Ezra from the tribe of Levi lead a group of Jews back to Judah 60 years after the temple's completed, to start rebuilding the worship at the temple. The whole rest of the book deals with the revival Ezra led, the restoration of the temple worship, and the rebuke to those that are living in sin contrary to God's word. Next in the line is the book of Nehemiah. We're going to skip that real quick, and chronologically, we're going to go to the book of Esther, because that is actually chronological next. Okay? So Esther happens between King Darius and King Artaxerxes. There's another king, like I said, not Artaxerxes, but just Xerxes. And Xerxes is one of these power-hungry kings. He's not necessarily like Cyrus was, or Darius was, or even Xerxes was. This guy is all about himself. He's an egomaniac. And the people he has surrounded himself with are very similar to this. They're egomaniacs. Easily offended. You guys know anybody that's easily offended? I think we live in a time where people are easily offended, aren't they? So one of his political flunkies, a guy by the name of Haman, was offended by a Jew named Mordecai. Haman didn't like this. So Haman hatched a plot to execute Mordecai. But it wasn't enough that he just execute the guy who offended him. He decided he'd take this another step further. We're going to execute all the Jews. Not just the guy, all of them. They're going to pay for all of it. I don't want any more of them here. It was a power thing. He wanted to be in control. So the book of Esther revolves around a Jewish woman who was actually married to the king at the time. And she caught wind of this plot to basically exterminate her entire people. So she is now in a position where she has to realize, am I going to stand up for my people? Or do I let this terrible thing happen? It's a big decision, right? How many of us have been in a place in our lives where you have to make a really tough one? If you're a boss, do you ever had to fire somebody? It's easy when they're just a complete and utter train wreck. It's not easy when they're a good person and there's just a little thing that we need to take care of. What about when your kid's in public school and you don't like what's being said? Do you just yank them out? Is that your stand? Or do you have a tough conversation with a teacher or an administrator or somebody else? What about when one of your brothers or sisters here sitting at the tables with us gets off the path? Do we have a conversation with them, and are we willing to do that? Or do we just stand back and watch the disaster unfold? This is where Esther's at. And you're like, no, Nick, it's not the same, it's not the same, it's not the same. No, it is the same. It's her people, I get it. But the guy sitting at the table is my people. So Esther's got to make a huge decision. And thankfully, she uses the wisdom God gives her and a lot of boldness, and she fights for her people. And to this day, the Jews keep a feast of Purim in remembrance of what Esther did 2,500 years ago. The most famous passage in the book is when Mordecai challenges her in Esther 4, chapter 4, verse 12 through 16. And he says to her, "And who knows that you have come to the royal position for such a time as this?" Denny, I think the last couple of Fridays we've had this conversation, haven't we? You get called by God to do something, and it just doesn't go as you thought it was going to go. So what's the lesson? What are we going to do with it? Is it a correction for you? Is it a correction for somebody else? Is it so you can show love to a person who doesn't know God? We're going to move on now backwards a book to Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a great book. If you've never read it, I would encourage you to read it. It is the last of the history books we're going to talk about in the good times and the bad times of the nation of Israel. Some 12 years after Ezra arrives in Jerusalem, God moved the heart of another person to do something significant for him. We've had a temple rebuilt. We've got worship happening inside the temple. And then there's this guy named Nehemiah. He's getting word from people that are already back in Judah that these other things are taking place, but the walls that protect the temple lay in ruins. So he is moved. But Nehemiah's got a little bit of a position with him. He is the cupbearer for King Artaxerxes. When I say cupbearer, I know when I was younger and I first heard this term, I thought, this guy just hands drinking water to the king. That's fantastic. It's not what happens. It's not what happens at all. I mean, he might give him a drink, but that's not what he's looking for. This cupbearer is kind of an untold right-handed man, as I would say. This guy has a little bit of influence and is often asked a little bit of opinion. And he has maybe this much power, but he has access to the king. And this can be a good thing or a bad thing, because if the king asks your opinion and you give it to him and it goes south when he takes your advice, you won't be a cupbearer for very long. But if it goes well, you'll move up the chain. Business owners in here, raise your hand. Okay. When you ask your employees something good, an opinion on something, and it goes well for you, you think highly of them, don't you? You look down on them a little bit with some favor. But when you ask their opinion and they give you the most ridiculous answer you've ever heard, they're not going to be in that position very long, are they? Okay? So Nehemiah has gained this position with his king, and his king says, you know what? We're going to go ahead and send you back. We're going to send you to Judah to rebuild the walls of the temple, or the walls surrounding the temple. And this starts to stir a real national pride and a spiritual identity inside of the people. This thing is a finished product. It is coming to a head. And when I say a national pride and a spiritual identity, the first thing that popped in my head when I was doing this was, unfortunately, a really bad series of events in our time as Americans. For anybody who's over the age of 30, you'll probably remember. If you're younger, you've probably heard about it in school. You got some version of it. Does anybody remember September 11, 2001? It was a rough day, wasn't it? Really rough day for Americans. We got beat up on that day. But out of all of that tragedy, in the hours, days, weeks, months, and I'll even say for a couple of years, came something inside of us that we were able to put aside our differences, quit nitpicking one another, and we were proud to be Americans again. Right? We wanted to buy American. We wanted to support all the causes. We had young men and women jumping at the opportunity. Heck, we had old men and women jumping at the opportunity to get back in the military or enlist. That's a national sense of pride. And that's what we're seeing here in Nehemiah. And it's such a difference maker in the lives of the Jews that this book is studied, business schools, military schools, and a lot of other places. This is a real book on administration, on motivation, and how to get things done. But if you read it Nehemiah does this through prayers. And he's got 11 recorded prayers that he used as he sought God's protection, his provision, and his guidance. Prayer. Imagine that. So we just looked at 5 books. Quick overview, well, maybe not so quick. Overview, okay? Moving forward, find something there. Dig into it. Look at what we just talked about. There's a lot. We covered good times and bad times. I would flip that. I would say the bad times were where we started. We watched the fall of Israel. We watched them be overtaken. But then we watched God move people to bring Israel back to the good times. The rebuilding of the temple, the rebuilding of the walls, the restoration of worship. Take a look at it. So the one lesson that stands out to me in all of this is none of it was done without prayer. It didn't matter if you were the king of another country who took over the Israelites. It didn't matter if you were the priest who wanted to restore worship. It didn't matter if you were the builder who was going to lay the walls for the temple or the guy who was going to build the wall that surrounded the temple. Every one of them asked God through prayer. So that's my takeaway here. I want you to focus on prayer. When your life feels like your temple's been crushed, your walls are broken, go back to God. Talk to Him. You don't have to be a priest to do this. You could be the gardener. I don't care. He doesn't care. He'll take any of us. So let us pray. Dear Father, we want to say thank you for your word. We want to say thank you for your promise. The promise that if we choose to come to you, you'll be there. The promise that even when we're not choosing to come to you, you don't pull the offer from the table. Lord, I ask that every one of us here, no matter what we're struggling with, no matter what we're celebrating, we come to you in prayer, whether that's Thanksgiving, whether that's entrusting, whether that's in asking for help. Father, help build us into a stronger nation. Help build us into a stronger church. And help us learn how to help each other. We ask all of this in your name. Amen.